We are so excited to have as our guest someone who is a parapsychologist, author, psychic intuitive, cartoonist, and artist, Dr. Pamela Hee.
Welcome to the show, Pamela.
Thank you for having me.
Could you just tell us and our guests a little bit about what got you interested in the paranormal field?
Well, I was having psychic experiences, and contrary to what I would have thought, which would be that, you know, either you were always psychic or you were never psychic, these started happening to me in my 30s, when I was already a doctor, had been a doctor for many years, and they were experiences that I think I probably ignored for quite a while as best I could, and eventually got to the point where I couldn't ignore them. There was just something too weird going on, and I decided I needed to figure it out mm-hmm. and try to understand why I seemed to be able to do things that science said were impossible.
And so that started you on your quest to find some answers for yourself.
Yeah, and it was sort of a long journey. I mean, first, being someone with a scientific background, I spent a bunch of time experimenting with myself. And, of course, the one advantage of using yourself for an experimenter is you know that you're not doing fraud. You know, you know if it's real or not. Mm-hmm. And I tested it for a good month, doing different little experiments myself just to see if whatever this was consistent or if it was my imagination. And eventually I realized, you know, it is real. And I started by getting some training at Casadega from a spiritualist. And I don't know if you know it, but there's only about 3 spiritualist camps in the United States. One of them is in Casadega, about a half hour north of Orlando, which is where I was working at the time. And I spent about 6 months working with Reverend Mary Smiley, who's a delightful woman. She charged $4 a lesson.
Wow.
She's really not in it for the money.
No.
And then I spent a couple years on the Navajo Reservation. And then I found out about a graduate school that was teaching parapsychology. And I actually moved to California just to be able to get my doctorate degree in parapsychology.
Well, and then working with that, you started working on your thesis and book.
In my matter interaction was actually my dissertation. I looked at 8 people who had experiences performing it. And I really didn't look at whether or not this was valid. And some people are more proof-oriented. They, like, how do you know for sure that each and every incident they describe was mind-matter interaction?
Okay, yes.
Their imagination. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm not going to worry about it. You know, I'm going to basically pick 8 people who I find very credible, who have stories that are very consistent with what's reported in the literature, and who have been tested in research labs and found to have these abilities. And I'm going to just assume, you know, these experiences are going to have some kind of meaningful information. And the experiences ran the gamut. It was sports interactions, spiritual stuff happening in prayer. It was fire walking, kind of secular bent, spoon bending, healing. I tried to get as many different types of experiences as I could because I figured the broader a range I looked at, the easier it would be to sort of chew them down to common traits and use something called phenomenology, which is a very well-established technique used in psychology, sociology, and some other fields for basically boiling down something to its core essence. And it was very interesting what came out of it. Basically, that's what the PK Zone, my first real book was all about, was talking about those experiences in the last third of the book, and with a sense of what does this mean? Not just what are these experiences, but what does this tell us about the phenomena itself? And things like altered states of consciousness, things like that, that are very common to anyone who's done this. I mean, it was interesting. I went back to a number of people, both the performers I'd originally talked to and others, and I said, this is what my take is on the core experience. Does this feel right to you? And everybody said yes. Yes, it really feels like you got it.
And now that one has been updated and is in the process of going through publication.
I'm working to get it mainstream published. I've actually pulled the PK Zone from print. There's going to still be a few copies floating around for a while. The new version is going to have some topics that weren't in the old one. I'm going to be looking more at different types of biological system research. I'm going to be looking at the steering studies. I'm going to be looking at multiplication of matter. So I picked some extra topics. I've also updated some of the research, not that there's been a lot of research on mind-matter interaction, but there's been some.
Yeah.
And it'll be hopefully updated to about 2009 this year by the time it gets published, but it may be a couple years before it's actually out.
Our main theme is spirited history, and I know that you have also investigated several different locations that are purported to have been haunted, and one of my questions was to see what you think about place memory. And first of all, I guess for our listeners, tell us or describe what place memory means when someone uses that term, and then what your opinion is of the role of that in dealing with a possible purported haunted site or historic site.
Well, there seems to be some kind of energetic or information imprint that can be created in the environment. And I have done a literature review on this topic. Place memory is sometimes referred to people as residual hauntings, or I've heard people talk about it as a stone tape theory. But it talks about the fact that there seems to be some kind of information that can get stored by objects and environments, which can be read back by those who are sensitive to that information. Mm. And one of the things I've looked at, I've actually published some journal articles on this, is that there may be more than one way by which place memory can be laid down or stored or recorded, because we're still trying to sort out exactly what's going on. But it looks like there may be two ways. One may is probably a very passive, repetitive way, you know, like everyone's heard of the Scottish ghost that's walking the ramparts of the castle and playing the bagpipes and stuff.
Right.
And if somebody were to do that, 400 times a year or whatever, or every night for 400 years, the repetition of it seems to be able to imprint in a very passive way. There may also be an active form of imprinting place memory, which involves mind-matter interaction. And what you'll notice is the same kinds of things that can improve spontaneous experiences, such as high emotion, will also tend to lead towards recording a place memory of a single time event or just a few times event. So if you talk about murders or you talk about a rape, these things are very high emotional events. They seem to be able to get recorded onto the environment in a way that it's relatively easy for psychics and other sensitives to read that information back later, even though it only happened at one time. It's not something that happened over and over and over and over. So it looks like there's two different ways that place memory can be recorded. Now, the thing that's important for people to understand about place memory is you don't have to be dead for place memory of you to exist. And I actually have run into people who had recorded place memory on a house and didn't realize what they were doing, but they were going through a divorce and were pretty emotional at the time and yada yada, and other people read that later. They're still living. Okay, so place memory doesn't come from ghosts. It comes from the living, and you can still be living when somebody comes back and reads that memory. So I think those are sort of important sort of differences between place memory and dealing with a live ghost or conscious spirit.
That's really interesting. I think there's another author that we've talked to. He kind of suggested the same thing in the battlefields.
Oh gosh, yeah. Well, you're gonna have a lot of emotion there, yeah, a lot of fear, a lot of anger, a lot of everything.
Everything.
It makes sense that you would see it imprinted very loudly onto a location. You know, and it's interesting. I mean, people have also done experiments in England where they ran electric currents through walls and seemed to be able to get sound. So sometimes you seem to be able to actually record auditory signals and not just information.
Exactly.
So you might hear or actually be able to record on physical tape or digital media the sound of gunshots or something else that gets played back when you run electric currents through stone walls. So, you know, I haven't actually been involved in any of those experiences directly, but they sound very interesting, and hopefully they'll be pursued more later.
Oh, I hope so, too. In fact, the other author we were talking with about the battlefields had even said not only the emotional aspect of the memories being stored there, but the new ones being made by those that reenact.
Yeah, that would make sense to me, but that would be more of the passive way, you know, the repetition. But if you go to my website, to the PDF gallery, my journal articles are available online for download, and you can download and read them. I was looking partly just to see what parapsychologists had said about place memory in the past, because it is actually a very old term. It's been used since the early 1900s, but its meaning has kind of morphed and changed over the years. So it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing as when parapsychologists first started using it.
Well, that's what I like about your website here, and the fact that you're sharing information, and it's so accessible out there to everyone to use. It's just wonderful. There are so many people out there in the field that I guess are guarded, and you're doing a good service here by having it available and for people to utilize and add to, and I think it's just a great thing you're doing. Well, it's helped me a lot.
I think that you'll find in general, if you're dealing with people who are members of the Parapsychological Association, that we tend to try and put all of our papers online. And you can, and this is with the permission of the journals and the editors for those journals. It's the kind of field where we really are trying to share information, and so most of the time the journals are happy to let you put anything out, you know, on your site that you've written. There's also, however, if you're interested in it, the online parapsychological library, which is subscription. You do have to pay an annual fee, but you can research any topic you want in, like, oh, the last time I looked, like 5 or 6 different parapsychological journals.
That's great.
Text search it. So if you want to see what's been written about place memory, mind matter interaction, whatever, you can do it online now. And I think that, more than anything else, is really going to advance the field. I just find it incredibly exciting.
Yes, I'm excited about it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm accessing everything I can. It's like, oh, read this, read that. So we're definitely, for our listeners, going to give links on our site to Dr. Pamela Heath's site, as well as where they can go and look at the
Online
journals.
Library. Yeah, and the Parapsychological Association website is also a good resource. People tend to underestimate it, but it doesn't just list members. It also has links to our websites. And most members do have their journal articles online available for download as PDF files. I mean, we really are trying to get the information out there if we can.
I think that's imperative for the field to grow I mean, if people are hoarding information, it's not doing anybody any good. And I think Angela wants to ask some questions about some of the historic sites that you've been to.
We know that you went to Alcatraz with and did the program Dead Famous. What were some of your experiences while you were there, and what do you feel is going on at that site?
There have been so many psychics there and so many Native American ceremonies that really the majority of the ghosts or spirits have moved on. But there does seem to be quite a lot of place memory. I actually would have to say I don't find it a particularly scary place. That's just me.
Right.
You know, to a certain extent, though, you can draw things to you depending on what you're looking for.
Yes.
And I tend to have a fairly high level of energy. I don't tend to attract the low-level entities so much, but I think if you're looking for low-level entities, whether they are actually on the rock or whether they come join you, because you're sort of putting out a little lighthouse saying, come to me, I want to be scared, you know, I want to have a good time. I don't know, but there aren't a lot of ghosts there from what I could tell.
Ah, okay.
Most of them have moved on. It's also that people, when you see ghosts, they usually hang out where they lived. Most of them hang out where they were happy. You really don't find them typically in graveyards or, I mean, sometimes they will be stuck in prisons, especially if they were a little bit insane when they died and they're still confused and they don't really understand that they're dead and they haven't finished crossing over and that kind of thing. But it's very easy for a spirit to leave where they died. Basically, once they've gotten over the fact that they feel tethered, some of them do feel like they're actually physically tethered to where their body is. But most of them say eventually, even if they believe that, eventually that tether dissolves. And then whatever they think of, wherever they think of, they're there. So most of them, sooner or later, they're going to stop thinking about being stuck, you know, in a cell or whatever, and they're going to start thinking about people they missed or places they liked, whatever. And then they can be there, too.
It makes more sense. I mean, why would you want to spend eternity tethered to someplace that made you miserable? I mean, unless they don't understand they can move on, why wouldn't you?
Well, I've done a fair bit of research for this. I've got a new book that'll be coming out with John Climo in April 2010 called Handbook to the Afterlife. And one of the things I had sort of noticed about books on the afterlife is most of them, they only talk about two things. They talk about the transition, and they talk about the afterlife as if it was a monolithic, you know, single thing. Sort of like, well, first you're living, and then you make your transition, and then bam, your afterlife, and that's it. And what I realized from all the reading I had done on channel material is that there seem to be consistent stages that most spirits seem to go through in the afterlife. It's not this sort of uniform event, you know, you're not there and then you're there. It's just like with children that they learn different stages, or with dying, people go through different stages. With grief, people go through different stages. In the afterlife, there are different stages. And, you know, the first thing they have to do is they sort of have to recognize they're dead, and then they have to separate from the body. And that separation from the body can be a tricky thing in part because it can depend a little bit on the beliefs that you held before you died. So those people who believed that there was a silver cord tethering them to the body, or they believed that if they died before their time, for whatever reason, that they would be tied to their body, you kind of get a self-fulfilling prophecy. And they will stay by the body until it, you know, rots or is gone or cremated, whatever. There do seem to be some people who go through that, but there are others who don't, which makes it sound suspiciously like it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's your own beliefs getting fulfilled. After that, then, of course, there's being greeted by spirits. You have moving through levels. You have a reunion phase. You have a rest and recovery phase, which may or may not include visits to the living. Of course, the life review and judgment phase, which is probably one of the best known phases of the afterlife. But it's also followed by spiritual work and what seems to be preparation for reincarnation, if you believe in that. And so we look at these different stages, how people seem to, or how spirits seem to go through them, and the different problems a spirit can get into at the different levels, and how you can help them at those different junctures. So we kind of broke it down in a way that I don't think people have really done before. It's not going to be surprising to anybody. Everybody's going to go, oh, yeah, right, of course. But nobody's really looked at it quite that way.
Oh, that's going to be a great resource. I can hardly wait to read that one.
Yeah, we're going to try to make it shorter than the last one. We're aiming for about half the size of the last one, so that it really is a handbook. And we're trying to keep it more concise. We're actually, we're not putting a lot of quotes. We're kind of coming at it from a different point than the suicide book. With the suicide book, John and I were really trying to prove a point, which was we are not making this material up. This material is really out there. And anyone who has access to all those different books is going to find what we found. But we kind of had that sort of academic need to prove ourselves mm-hmm. and to say, okay, we're saying you see this, well, these are the books where, you know, we can quote you where mm-hmm. it's talked about. With this book, we're not doing that. We're saying, you know what, we read all this material, we've digested it for you, and this is the Cliff Notes version.
And here it is, exactly.
Yeah, here it is. So it is going to be a different style, but we're trying to make it a simpler, quicker, easier read.
Another one of the sites that you had been to was in New Zealand.
Oh, God, I love New Zealand. Yeah, I've been there many times.
Oh, I definitely want to visit the caves there where the glowworms are.
Oh,
I just can't imagine.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Was writing, actually, at the time I was writing a fiction story about somebody who was traveling through New Zealand, and she was psychic and was ghostbusting. And so I realized I was going to have to go to New Zealand, and I was going to have to check out these places firsthand.
Well, that must have pained you.
I was very lucky, actually. I started a lifelong friendship out of it because I found the New Zealand Ghosts website, which is ntghost.co.nz. Mm-hmm. And it listed all these different haunted places in New Zealand. So I started writing back and forth with the webmaster for it. And we struck up a friendship. And I did go to quite a few places that were haunted. And a combination. Some were ghosts. Some felt like more place memories. Some are both.
Yeah.
The Maori, which are the one of the indigenous peoples there, though, mm-hmm. do not like to talk much about the ghosts. They believe very much in the spirit realm, mm-hmm. but if you talk to the more traditional ones, they're afraid of ghosts. They feel ghosts can suck your energy, and they're potentially very negative, scary beings. So they don't like to talk about it. The newer generation doesn't really believe that, but it's sort of interesting trying to get them to talk about these things. Next to the glowworms is the Waitomo Caves Hotel, mm-hmm. which is pretty well known to be haunted, and I did have some very interesting experiences there and was getting some interesting EMF readings, too. There seemed to be a variety of things going on there, a variety of spirits, not just one. And there were also some on the grounds, too. There's some sacred ground not far from there, and I did feel like there were some guardian spirits, but I did not feel at all threatened by them. I felt like they were watching,
mm-hmm.
and as long as you weren't, you know, you weren't disrespectful, you know, they were fine with you being there. I didn't feel any danger at all from them. There was, in fact, in general, those spirits weren't bad. There was a very playful spirit that kept opening my door until I asked to stop, and then there was another one that they all kind of knew about, who used to be a handyman for mm-hmm. the hotel, who passed on, and then a number of people cited him afterwards, but they felt he was just sort of keeping an eye on the place, taking care of it, you know. So nothing too negative there. Larnach Castle in Dunedin, which is on the South Island, was very haunted also. And it's actually been checked out by lots of different paranormal groups there. Mm-hmm. And you get all kinds of interesting EMF readings, even beyond what is clearly very poor wiring. You know, if you get a lot of straight current, you know, sometimes it's from their security system and stuff. But there is one of the original Mrs. Larnach is still there, and I found was on a yellow chair a lot, and she was kind of hostile. She's not too fun, especially as they let me go back after hours, and she didn't like that I was there, and I told her she made me feel it.
That's interesting.
There's also, for those who want to go to New Zealand, there's also a little motel next door to Larnach Castle. You don't stay in the castle itself, but mm-hmm. next door to it. And one of my fellow guests came up to me, and his wife was like, you got to tell her. I'm like, tell me what? He had an experience in the middle of the night where he woke up, and he was cold.
Oh.
And someone pulled his blankets up over his arm, and he turned to thank his wife. And she was sound asleep.
Oh, my goodness.
So a ghost was taking care of him. So that seemed to be more of a hostess type spirit.
I was going to say comfy and cozy.
Yeah, but sometimes I think it's just like dealing with people. Sometimes how you approach them will affect how they interact with you.
That's what Angela and I have found. As long as we're
definitely
approach with respect or decorum, or
and also with sort of calm strength. You know, I have definitely some pretty sound boundaries and solid boundaries, and I won't take a lot of crap from anybody, living or dead. And, you know, that sort of got enhanced by being an anesthesiologist and dealing with surgeons all the time. You hold boundaries.
Oh, and
the same is true for spirits. And it's like, I have my limits, you know, and I expect them to be respected. And sometimes that will work really well with ghosts because they're like, don't mess with her.
She'll go off on you.
She's not going to tolerate any stuff, you know. So I think if you're fearful, there are spirits that will take advantage of that and say, oh, let's have some fun.
Oh, look, a new one.
Yeah, let's play with this one. You know, it's interesting. When I first started doing investigations, I really didn't do a lot of preparation. And I think part of it was kind of a misconception that I had that it would be cleaner research if I didn't know what I was getting into as a situation. Mm-hmm. And it's really a false or an inaccurate thought to approach it that way, because in point of fact, most parapsychologists have come to realize, somewhat sadly, that there's no such thing as a blind situation. Whether you call it single blind, double blind, triple blind, it doesn't exist. Because with ESP, there's no way to prevent somebody from having some sense of what is going to happen or what's going on. The only thing you can do is try and cut down on conscious overlay. You know, and you can talk to Dean Radin, any parapsychologist, and or kind of admit that. What I found over the years is that there's no need to walk blindly into a situation, and there's a lot of advantages to not doing that, especially if you tend to have a practical approach, which I do. I am not so much into trying to prove the reality of these things, because I don't think that somebody who doesn't believe can ever be convinced, no matter how much research you show them. They just aren't going to hear it. They'll always find an excuse not to. But if you prepare, you can be much more effective when you finally get on the investigation. And part of this is because ghosts are different from spirit guides in that they tend to have the same basic personality and belief systems or worldview as they had when they were alive. And this is sort of a double-edged sword for them. You can actually use their beliefs to help get through to them, but they're also limited by their beliefs. So one of the advantages of preparation is you can get a sense of who they are, what they believe, and what they might respond to. And that can be especially helpful if you're dealing with ghosts from other cultures. Mm-hmm. For example, there have been some times I've run into Japanese POWs from World War II. And if I want to get through to them, I can plan in it. You know, you tune in and you sense, oh, okay, there's these Japanese guys, and they don't really understand what's going on. But they come from that cultural worldview. Well, then knowing that worldview, I can say, let me bring things that will be not only comforting to them, make them feel like they can connect to me, but can also act as aids and cues to them as to what's really going on. So, for example, I have some true Japanese prayer beads from Japan. I will bring Japanese incense, you know, and other things that they may look at and they recognize, oh, you only use these prayer beads when someone's dead.
Exactly.
Sort of a cue to them, they are dead. You're giving them incense to help them join their ancestor spirits or recognizing them as a spirit now. It's a cue, and these can actually be very effective. Something I even use, and I've mentioned this a few times, even with, for example, suicides, I'll bring the suicide book with me, and I'll visualize an astral version that I hand them to read and say, okay, this will explain everything.
Ah.
It's actually been very effective. They can see it because I have it in with me in the physical plane. And if I visualize handing them an astral version, I don't think they even realize it's been duplicated. They just know it's there because they could see it, and I'm handing it to them in a version they can read.
You see, and that's what Angela and I are trying to do with really knowing who and what we might be encountering.
Right.
And doing some type of cultural acknowledgement in either that time period or custom or ethnic value or belief system to try and relate with. I think that's fabulous with the prayer beads. I think that's an excellent cue. Oh my gosh,
right.
You know.
I mean, you can even use, you can even bring the Islamic Book of the Dead, the Egyptian Book of the Dead,
the Tibetan
Book of the Dead. All of these books will have prayers you're supposed to read to the dead. If they come from that culture, they know if they're hearing that prayer, somebody is dead. And it just makes it easier to get through to them what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Almost definitely.
The other kind of case where I find it helpful is with what I would call negative entities. Entities that are hostile or, in some cases, even dangerous. And I've found over the years that you will be safer if you do a lot of preparation before you walk into these situations rather than get blindsided by them.
Yes.
And it's a combination of things that I'll do. I will start usually by meditating, and I'll also try and put myself into a very focused mindset that is either total neutrality or else unconditional love. Because those are the only two real emotional states, pure emotional states that you can be in. And they can't get a handle on you.
Right.
For one thing, unconditional love, they don't much care for that. You know? They will, if anything, it repels them a little, I think. Neutrality works, too. And I mean total neutrality, no emotion, neither positive nor negative, just you simply are. And you're simply doing what needs to be done, and there's no anger, there's no fear. And that's really important. I think you have to be very careful because negative entities will use emotions against you.
Yes.
You know, unless you're really careful. And in addition to the meditation and putting yourself in this mindset, I will put, in fact, on almost every investigation, I'll put a shield around myself before I come anywhere near it.
And well, that makes sense.
A self-maintaining shield of white light, nothing but good can come in, nothing but good can go out, and really focus on being protected. If I am also dealing with something that feels very powerful, I will either link with guides and ask for their help, or I will sometimes actually link with other groups of psychics. And that case in the Rita Hayworth thing, I knew a month ahead of time what I was going to be dealing with. I was getting all kinds of psychic hits about this entity down there. And I actually talked to about four or five friends, and I said, look, I'm going to be, you know, dealing with this. Can I pull power from you? Can I pull energy from you? And got their permission. And so on the day, I knew that if I needed it, I could draw on it. And I think that really gave me the confidence that I found I didn't need it, but it was nice knowing it was there.
Oh, yeah.
Safety net. And you can do that if there are psychics that you're used to working with in circles. You know, like the two of you are used to working together. I'm sure you automatically link when you're doing work with something that, shall we say, could be touchy situation. And it does give you more ability. And it is your comfort zone.
Yeah, I feel like Angela's got my back.
Exactly. And you don't have to be physically with others to do that, especially if you've, you know, I have a lot of friends, and, you know, we'll call up, we'll do little circles on the phone, that kind of thing, and read for each other and stuff. And you get very much used to working with each other and get used to each other's energy. That means if you're going somewhere, you can link to them if you have permission to do so in advance or away from you. You don't have to call them on the phone. They don't have to be with you. You just say, okay, if I need it, you know, can I link?
Bring it on.
And again, I think as much as anything else, it improves your confidence and your comfort, and that, again, helps you keep the correct mindset of neutrality or of unconditional love. But I do believe in preparing, and I would recommend that. I think the only thing you have to remember is if you like to get psychic information about where you're going beforehand, you have to remember that when the day comes, you're also open to new information or to things having changed, you know, and corrected. But it will keep you from being blindsided, and it can help you know what you should bring with you that you might need, you know, to work as physical cues to aid the dead.
Oh, that's excellent, valuable information you just gave.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I don't actually feel any physical objects are needed. I know some people like certain ritual objects always. And I think it just improves their comfort zone, but it's not really necessary, and it's kind of a crutch. If you feel you need it for you, I think that can be a problem. It's good to outgrow that. But if you feel like you're not using it for you, but you're using it for them, mm-hmm. the ghost, then that's a different matter entirely, you know, because they are limited by their beliefs, and you have to be able to adapt to that. If they're not harming others, if they're not actively trying to hurt other people, I'll usually respect those boundaries and let it go. The only time I push it is if they are trying to hurt others. And I know I was in a, I was doing a show that actually I never filmed, that was north of San Francisco in a haunted house. And there were several different spirits in the place, but one of them was sort of up in a sort of bell tower area, which they didn't normally let people go into because folks had been hurt and scared in there. And there was a ghost, the male ghost, that he was going to push me down those stairs, and they were very, very steep, and you could break your neck on it. And I tell you, I threatened to haunt him to the end of his days if he didn't.
That's great.
Seriously, because he sort of went to the other far corner of the room. You can set boundaries, you know, if somebody's trying to hurt people. Now, with him, I let him stay because they keep that area locked off, and so he's not generally a problem. I have run into people, spirits. I did, at the Rita Hayworth episode of Dead Famous, there was a spirit at the Palace Theater that was really, really negative. And he was actually haunting a whole block area of L.A. and had a gang of ghosts that he was running and was pulling energy from the living. And he was looking for somebody to take over, so that he could sort of get back to his old ways of stuff, which were not good ways. And I did force him on. I don't do that very often.
Well, something like that, I would say, needs
to
be.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and that kind of stuff didn't make the show. It's sort of interesting. You know, some of the real stuff doesn't make the show. They're more interested in trying to tell a particular story, which they usually have planned out before you even set foot and start filming.
Angela and I call that para entertainment.
and there's nothing wrong with it as long as.
And I love it. I watch it. Exactly, I watch it myself. So
yeah,
and
you just have
it.
To take what you see and you know realize. Yeah, you know, they have to entertain. So
exactly.
Yeah, and the other thing I think a lot of people don't realize, if you haven't been in the TV world, it's like the Alcatraz episode I did for Dead Famous the Mob. We spent from 2 o'clock in the afternoon till probably almost 2 o'clock in the morning filming. And it was, 15-20 minutes? And that probably includes commercials. So, I mean, it's just amazing how much can be going on, and you're only getting pieces of it. And they will edit those pieces together to try and make a cohesive story, which may or may not reflect what really happened. And sometimes there's a great deal more that happens. Then you realize there was certainly a lot more that happened at Alcatraz, but it was... there was a tremendous amount of place memory that Chris Fleming was getting, and getting very accurately, and actually getting feedback that he was on the money with it. And they totally cut it out. It was just sort of amazing to me.
That's a shame.
They cut out. There was a spirit he felt he connected to that he moved on also, which mostly got cut out also. And I thought that was kind of a shame because it was it was really neat to watch and be part of.
I also want to talk to you about the USS Hornet.
Oh, one of my favorite places.
Well, it has to be. You volunteer there and...
Yeah, I'll be there Saturday doing a flashlight tour again.
Oh, awesome. Well, tell us all about the USS Hornet.
USS Hornet is an aircraft carrier from World War II, and it's highly decorated. It was actually considered a very lucky ship. It was never hit in battle, and it holds a lot of records for the most pilots who became an ace in a day and... you know, planes shot down, and there was a period of about 18 months during World War II when it was basically the only aircraft carrier in the Pacific holding the line against the Japanese, and they could not go back to port because there was no one to replace them. The other ships had all been damaged and had to be in port for repairs. So she has a very proud military history, and just a most amazing, amazing ship, just from a purely historical viewpoint. She was also a ship that picked up the Apollo astronauts, and she would have picked up another set, but Apollo 13 had the fire and people were killed. And then they ended up decommissioning her in, I believe, 1970. And she sat in mothballs for a long time. Now, before she was decommissioned, most people feel she was not haunted. And it is only after they decided to turn her into a museum ship that the spirits started coming on board. And many people feel that part of their reason for coming on board was to help it become a museum. And there are many stories of how they actually did try to help it become a museum. They would materialize chain and do other things. The majority of the spirits are, there's sort of like three groups of spirits on the Hornet. The majority of them are what I would think of as guides. They're beings that already went to the light, and they came back, and they've got a purpose there. And, you know, they're helping out with the ship. And they look at the living, you know, those of us who volunteer and work as staff on the ship, as being fellow crew members. So it's a very comfortable, friendly kind of environment. At least I find it that way. There are a few spirits still that are stuck. Mostly they're in areas that the public don't go. And occasionally I do cross their paths. I move them on when I can. But I would say there are not a lot of those. It's relatively few. Many people feel the ship herself has a spirit. And I don't know whether this is something like a thought form where people have believed in the ship for so long that they kind of created something or not. But it does almost, I mean, a lot of people have felt this way, that she almost has, the ship almost has a personality. Most of the time I'm dealing with the guides, and they come on the ship for the same reason that the volunteers do. They simply liked it. It's not that they died there. It's that they had the time of their life there. They loved it, you know, and this is a happy place. They're aware of each other. They're not stuck. You know, they interact. They still have a hierarchy. And many people have seen one of the admirals and a number of others. So they have this whole rank structure.
Oh, that's great.
Which has been helpful because sometimes if one of the guys lower down the line gets out of line, there was one guy who was harassing one of the secretaries. He liked her. She thought she wasn't Hawaiian, but he thought she looked kind of Hawaiian, and he had a thing for Hawaiian women. And, I just said, you know, well, take it up the chain of command. the captain talks to him, and the behavior stops. You know, so it's kind of fun when you have a whole chain of command you can deal with.
How marvelous.
Take it up to their superiors.
Yes, talk to the superior officer. Go report
That's
in.
Right. Yeah, they have a whole rank. But I enjoy those guys. How many spirits you see on the ship will vary from day to day. I think the most I've ever seen is on Pearl Harbor Day. And it's like there's massive reunion on the
ship. I'm sure. Well, it sounds like if they can come and go, it would make sense on a day like that.
Yeah, very few of them died on the ship. The other thing that's interesting about the ship is you would think that a warship would have some heavy-duty place memory. And most of the place memory on that ship is actually pretty happy or neutral. It's you feel people rushing around. You feel this busyness. You know, you have this sense of purposeful activity. But there's only a few places on the ship that have an unpleasant energy to them. There's one where outside a bomb elevator where a bomb exploded and someone was killed, that's kind of yucky. And everybody, you know, almost every psychic that goes through the ship will notice that one. But there's very few spots like that on the ship. It's really a really happy ship. It's not a scary ship. It's a nice place.
I've never been, but looking at the site and looking at the history of it and what they're, you know, how you can visit and the different exhibits, it looks wonderful. And the restoration projects that they're doing right now, we'll definitely put links up.
They're really struggling financially because, in fact, ever since September 11th, tourist rate, you know, dropped off, travel dropped off.
Oh, absolutely.
And it is an incredible place. And just from a pure historical viewpoint, this ship did so much to keep us all safe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, you forget things like that sometimes. And you know, everywhere you look on that ship is just really interesting. We have far more open, more levels open, more rooms open, more tours than I think just about any other museum ship. And we've really tried to keep it very true to the original. Some ships on the East Coast, I understand they've cut regular rectangular doorways in.
Right.
There's so much time on the Hornet. Let me tell you, every so many feet, you pick your knee up really high
to go over the
special things, you know.
Oh, no.
Like, You don't even think about it, you know. You go to a fight area, it doesn't matter. You're picking your feet up every something.
Up goes your leg, up and over.
Yeah. Most of those goats are friendly, though, and a number of them have been reported being heard by different staff members, like, watch your step, sir, things like that. They're very polite spirits. I've only run into a few grumpy ones there.
Well, what would you say, is there a big difference between the feel on the USS Hornet and the Queen Mary? They're both ships.
Oh, wow, yeah. Yeah, quite a bit of difference. The Queen Mary seems to have different groups. Like the Hornet, a lot of people who are there because they really enjoyed sailing on the Queen Mary. It was a great time. But you have two almost completely different groups. You've got the ghosts that used to work on the ship, and you've got the ghosts that were passengers. And so it's sort of a different structure. You don't have that same command structure. I also would say there were a lot more spirits on the Queen Mary than are on the Hornet. I went there for a weekend, and I swear it was like every 5 minutes the whole weekend. They were, you know, there was something coming up to talk to me. And I moved on an amazing number. And there were many others that insisted on staying. They really wanted to stay. There also seemed to be some POWs there. And I found out later that apparently they did hold POWs there for a while. So several different groups, very, very, very busy. I actually would put out a closed sign mentally when I wanted to go to bed at night. You know, and I actually asked a couple of the Hornet ghosts to go with me and stand guard at the door to keep the others from coming, because it was like just a nonstop line all day long. And I would say it was very interesting.
I want to also let our listeners know that on your website, you have an area where you have audio talks, and I have found those to be so helpful, especially for Angela and I when we had, again, a site we're going to highlight in a couple weeks. Moving spirits onto the light just really came in so handy. Tell us a little bit about your audio talks that are available.
I did a few audio talks. One's about spirits, moving spirits on. I think another is about psychic self-defense and protection. Of course, the best defense is to be a total skeptic. very, very hard for ghosts to influence you when you're convinced they do not exist.
Absolutely.
But for those of us who are more vulnerable because of our beliefs, you have to understand that intention and imagination do seem to have a certain amount of power. Just as I mentioned before, belief has self-fulfilling prophecy capabilities. And it's not just in the spirit realm. It's in our everyday life, too. Well known to psychologists, how we all sort of create our own versions of realities, and whether it be with rose-colored glasses or otherwise. I think one of the things that I like to sort of point out to people about moving spirits on is it doesn't have to be hard. It's amazing to me how often I'll see mediums or others on shows, and they're acting like this is such a struggle, this is so much effort, this is taking a lot of energy, oh, I can only move one on at a time, the others have to wait. And I'm like, why? You know, just bring a train from the light, load everybody up, the spirit guides and conductors, load everybody up on the train, and have the train all go out at the same time, you know. Just do it in mass.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that says you can't do that. And I think the other thing that can be sort of fun that keeps you from burning out at moving spirits on, because this is something I do pretty regularly, is to be creative with it and have a little fun with it. You don't have to do it the same way every time, and you can sort of use, if you're intuitive, you can kind of use your own sense about what they will find acceptable. If they're afraid of a train, you know, maybe they'd like a horse and buggy, maybe they'd like a rocking horse if they're a 2-year-old child, you know, whatever works. And I'm a big believer in whatever works. The other thing, I guess, that a lot of people seem surprised by is there's nothing to keep you from just calling someone to come from the light and come get them. And it can be anybody. I mean, it can be anybody they would recognize. And in point of fact, I don't think they even have to be dead, because a spirit guide can look like anybody they want to. So
well,
if they want Uncle Joe to come get them, ask either Uncle Joe or a guide who looks like Uncle Joe to come get them and just get them moved on.
Well, it certainly came in handy for Angela and myself. And
oh, yeah.
So thank you for having those available. And again, for our listeners, we'll have a link so that you can click on and listen to the MP3 files. And
yeah, I have a lot of fact pages, too, things if they don't want to listen to the audio file. Many things mm-hmm. are written down as fact pages that you can easily print out if you want. And part of why I did that is certain questions get emailed to me frequently.
I'm sure. So oh, I'm sure.
Every time I sort of see a pattern and go, gee, a lot of people are asking this one, it tends to get added as a fact page. And I have three separate sections of fact pages, one for people who are intuitive or want to develop their intuitive abilities, one for people who want to know about parapsychology. Gosh, I guess I have to check my own website and see what the other one is. but I have them divided kind of in categories just to make it a little bit easier for you to find whatever you might be looking for. Let's see, the other group is how to do a ghost investigation mm-hmm. and just sort of general use things. And those are the four categories. And if you want to see a question answered there, you can always use the email address there and email me. And that seems like something that other people would be interested in. Instead of just sending a single email, I'll also put a fact page up.
Well, that's great. It's a great resource. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of articles. You definitely need to go check it out if you haven't yet.
Well, I also want to find out any up-and-coming books that are coming down the pike and any new events happenings for you?
Well, I already mentioned Handbook to the Afterlife. That's coming out from North Atlantic Books in April of 2010. And John Climo, my co-author from the Suicide Book, is putting on final touches on the manuscript now. Eventually, there'll be a new book called Mind-Matter Interaction, The Stories, Research, and Theory, which will replace the PK Zone, but I'm not quite sure when that's coming out. I have another nonfiction book that could be quite useful to people who are intuitive and otherwise, mm-hmm. talking about the personality of the unconscious mind and how to work with it. And since the unconscious mind is the gateway for all intuitive hits, as far as we can tell, mm-hmm. Learning how to work with it and improve your communication with yourself, shall we say, actually can benefit you a lot as a psychic. And that doesn't have a home yet in terms of a publisher.
Okay.
And I'm also been doing some fiction writing again, partly rewriting a paranormal novel I had written several years ago and sort of improving the style, rewriting it. Mm. And also I started a screenplay, a paranormal action-adventure screenplay recently, which is kind of fun. And when you look at my novels, they are just that. They are fiction, but to a certain extent, I do weave into the characters real experiences and the kinds of information or the kinds of personalities I've run into with ghosts. Because one of the things that sort of bugs me about a lot of the paranormal movies that are out right now mm-hmm. is they're all horror. It's like everything
yes.
is scary, everything is horror. And that's not been my experience with ghosts.
No.
Most of them have personalities just like the living do. And so one of the things I kind of enjoy doing in my fiction is taking experiences that I've had, real spirits that I have met, and putting them into these stories in ways that I find more real than what's been done in the past.
Oh, that's refreshing. I'm looking forward to reading some of your fiction.
Oh, I try to have quite a sense of humor with it. I've got some. to me, you know, originally doing the fiction, part of the reason I did it was to improve my nonfiction writing, because it sort of shifted my style away from academic double talk. Mm-hmm. But I do write fiction first and foremost to entertain myself. And so I like funny books. I like a lot of humor and jokes and funny things happening, and so that gets into the fiction too.
Well, I love your cartoons and your artwork as well.
The cartoons are a hint that I have a sense of humor.
Yes.
Yeah. The cartoons are something I started doing when I was in second grade, and I only have a small fraction of them up there. I found that being a cartoonist or being an artist, it doesn't matter which, being a writer, they're all forms of the same thing. A lot of it has to do with how you view yourself, your sort of identity, because if I'm doing cartoons, I'm looking for the humor in everything in life. The thing I find sort of interesting about writing is that it is very much like painting in the sense that you start by sketching out, you know, the basic structure, and then you work into greater and greater detail until you've finally built up your creation to something that is compelling, if you're lucky.
Well, I'm looking at one of your cartoons.
Sorry.
The staring contest. I was like,
I was married for a time. That was my ex-husband's cat, George. George was my new cat. And George and I would get into staring contests, I admit it. I did a lot of cartoons about George. George also ate socks.
Oh, lovely.
When I was in medical school, one of the things I would do to entertain myself was I would draw cartoons, and I wouldn't sign them, and nobody knew who I was, and I would post them. And then I would sit and wait for people to discover the cartoons. And the one thing I really regret is I don't have copies of those cartoons. And some of them were, I can still remember, were very funny.
That's wonderful.
But I should have kept copies. I kind of regret that now.
Wonderful and a little naughty.
Oh, yes. Some of them were. Some of them were. But I would get quite a chuckle out of watching people try and figure out who had done it. And they never picked me. So I guess I have a deceptively serious front.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being on our show. It's been such a delight, and we definitely want to have you back.
Oh, anytime. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much for being on the show.
All right. Thank you for having me.